Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
And good afternoon, everyone, from Florida's Space Coast on a warm Easter weekend. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the April 3rd, 2010 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, let's get started right away by inviting you to join us in this program today, anytime, by giving us a call, 321-768-1240. Or for our local AT&T wireless customers, just punch in star 1240 on your device and you'll be put into the studio right and direct. And if you're listening to us online, you can send us email anytime. The address is spacetalking@AOL.com. The screen is up right here in my studio and we're waiting for your comments and questions at any time. Well, let's see. Countdown clocks are ticking, as you heard at the top of the hour, for the launch of Space Shuttle Discovery. Liftoff remains set for 6:21 a.m. Eastern Time on Monday morning, less than an hour away from sunrise, and promises to make this perhaps one of the most spectacular shuttle launches we've seen in a long time, certainly one of the more spectacular launches in general. As Discovery climbs toward orbit, it will come out of the Earth's shadow and hit the sunlight at a very low angle, and I guarantee you that is going to be a sight worth getting up for if you're not already up at that time of the day. The seven-member crew arrived Thursday morning. The countdown officially began Friday morning. And so far, everything going well at Pad 39A. The weather looks good, 80% chance of acceptable conditions. Fog appears to be about the only concern at this point. And Shuttle Weather Officer Kathy Winters reporting just about an hour or two ago that fog this morning didn't look too bad, and she's optimistic for fog not being too bad of a problem on early Monday morning. And inside Discovery's cargo bay for the 13-day flight, a whole bunch of stuff that was the responsibility of NASA's Joe Dallai and his team at the Kennedy Space Center to prepare for launch. And Joe happens to be able to join us today by phone to talk about the mission. Joe, welcome back to Space Talk.
Good afternoon, Jim. It's an honor to be here again.
Good. Well, I'm glad to have you, and I know you're in the middle of a countdown, so we'll try to keep this brief. First of all, just give us the real basics. You're in charge of the payload. What is Discovery carrying?
Jim, it's an exciting mission as we're approaching the assembly complete for ISS in these next few missions. And we've been working on this payload for quite a while with our Italian friends and our Boeing and NASA folks. So we're all excited. We're going to have we have a pressurized logistics module.
Mm-hmm.
It has 16 racks in it. We have four storage racks. We have seven stowage racks. We have four utilization racks, and we have a crew quarters rack this flight.
So these racks is what these big kind of cabinets that go up into the space station and attached inside the different modules.
Right. Besides the crew quarters, we have an exercise system that's going up. We have a storage rack that's going to be going up on this flight. We have a refrigerator freezer going up. And we have what they call a wharf, which is a window observation research facility.
Okay.
That's going to be put in front of the windows, and it's going to allow the crew to use some of the most delicate and highest quality optics ever flown on a human spacecraft.
Oh, my.
And the module with the 16 racks, and we have about 7,000 pounds of storage, and the whole thing weighs about 27,000 pounds. We're also carrying up an ammonia tank, which the astronauts will put on the S-1 truss, and that will help with the cooling system on the radiators.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an exciting mission. Jim, we also have a lot of science middecks going up on this flight.
Yeah, it seems like this is a good mix of a lot of science to take advantage of the increased crew that's up there, the time they have available, as well as preparing for the time when shuttle's retired.
Exactly, and as we approach the assembly complete, we just keep putting up the science up there, and it's doing great things for folks here on Earth. One of the items we're bringing up is what they call an apex cambium.
Okay.
And this is going to be used to seek definitive evidence that gravity has a direct effect on these cambium cells, which contribute to the reaction of wood formation in gravity. One of the items, another item we're bringing up is called the Space Tissue Loss. And this is actually sponsored by the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research.
Okay.
And the purpose of this is to study cellular effects in microgravity for the immune system.
Okay.
So, again, the
real basic medical research.
Exactly. And the spinoffs for us here on Earth are going to be fantastic. We're also bringing up what we call an NLP. It's going to be a vaccine commercial payload in support of the National Pathfinder Initiative.
Okay.
And, again, you know, doing some of this research on space in a macrogravity environment and coming up, trying to come up with cures for vaccines is just wonderful up there compared to when you're on Earth.
Now, Joe, do you happen to know if this vaccine experiment is a follow-on to some of the ones that have flown in the last few missions over the last couple of years?
Yes. Some of the items are going to be a follow-on to what we've done before. And, of course, we have new items up there, too.
Yeah, I think the vaccine one has the potential to be really neat. I remember we were talking about, it's a salmonella poisoning that perhaps there's a way to actually vaccinate people that get it or are susceptible to getting it. And that purity in that zero gravity environment, that microgravity environment, just seems to be a real winner for those kind of experiments.
Oh, it's going to be fantastic.
So now this is flying. You're talking about the big multipurpose logistics module, which we know by the name of Leonardo in
yes.
this case. And this is the same module that's going to go up, I think, and stay. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. So what's going to happen when this gets back, we're going to turn it over to our other team, and they're going to have about 4 or so months to work with, again, Boeing, NASA, and our Italian friends, and they're going to refurbish it. They're going to enhance the shields on the outside, do some modifications inside, and this will be a permanent module on station because, as you know, Jim, the station is a lot of science up there, a lot of cargo, a lot of folks, and it's getting very crowded. So this is going to enable the crew to do a little housekeeping and put things in orderly fashion up there because they really need the room.
Well, and they need the room, and, of course, the other big thing that's neat about Leonardo on this flight is that it's making its last round-trip flight. It's bringing stuff back, and so I would imagine that as complicated and busy as it is to get everything packed up and sent up there, you're probably looking forward to bringing back a lot of stuff. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, when the module comes back, we're going to be bringing back the storage racks, but they're going to have items are not used up there anymore. There'll be some trash, you know, things like that. A lot of the science things that we talked about, some will stay, some will come back. A lot of times you'll put science up in space and the customer will say, well, I only want up there for 2 or 3 months. Can you bring it back? So we have to get this module back, get the science back. We have to unstow it, turn over the customers, deintegrate and turn this module around and get it ready so our friends can work on it for four and a half months for the permanent logistics module.
Hmm. Well, and you've got the two other logistics modules down here. Are they going up on some of these next couple flights? Are they all still in the pipeline?
Yes, the FM2 or FM3, the two other modules, we are working on those right now. Let's see, FM2 is going to be used in case in the future we have a launch on need mission, which has not been approved yet by the program,
okay.
But they're looking at options in case we have to resupply in the near future. So there's, they're going to be used, and we're using FM3 to help us with spare parts on the other modules. So, we have a lot of work.
A lot of stuff going on. And tell me real quick, what's next for you as payload manager? You've got one or two more assignments left?
Oh, you bet. I'm real excited. We have a mission coming up in the mid-year, which is called ULF-6.
Okay.
And right now we're going to be flying a deck with what we call ORUs, orbital replacement units, that are going to be needed for on-orbit. And the deck will actually be taken out of the cargo bay. It will be put onto ISS, and as these OIUs are needed, the crew can get those and change them out. And then we also have an
exchange. Hang on, John. I'm going to have to cut you off here. But thanks for being on with us today. Good luck with the countdown, and we're going to talk to you more about your mission as we get further along. So thanks for being here. This is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Behnke. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
And welcome back to Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. 321-768-1240, the number to call to join me today with your questions or comments. Or once again, you can send email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, we're bouncing around a little bit here on subjects, and let me tell you, it was 40 years ago this month that the infamous flight of Apollo 13 took place and accomplished what NASA has often called its most successful failure. You've all heard the story time and again. You've all seen the movie by Ron Howard. And by the way, if you haven't ever seen the movie, then what are you waiting for? You know about the crew. You know about the explosion, about the lunar module lifeboat, the safe return to Earth. And, of course, I thought I knew the whole thing, too. And then suddenly I find out there's something new. And it's all the fault of space historian Andrew Chaikin, author of A Man on the Moon, The Voyages of the Apollo Astronauts, and several other fantastic books, I might add. He is a former co-worker of mine, a longtime colleague, a respected friend. And Mr. Chaikin joins us on the phone today. Andy, welcome.
Hey, Jim. It's good to be back with you.
Good. Well, you just couldn't let history alone, could you? You wrote the definitive book about Apollo, and then you had to go and make some history, too. Tell us.
Oh, well, I can't claim that. I just bring the history to the to the folks who are interested in it. But it was really neat to find out something about Apollo 13 that I never knew, and most people, I guess nobody knew, really, because it had never been figured out before.
Well, let's talk about, and of course, we're talking about the end of the mission and what would have happened if the crew hadn't been rescued, hadn't returned to Earth. Tell us what we've always thought we knew, and tell us what you found out.
Well, actually, Jim, back when I was at space.com, 10 years ago, getting ready for the 30th anniversary.
Right.
A company named AGI, we got in touch with them, and that's Analytical Graphics. We got in touch with them and asked them to do an animation for the anniversary and to run the actual flight path of Apollo 13 and make a graphic that showed all the mission events as if you were following along with it in space.
Right.
And they had, you know, they still do great, really great stuff. You know, they did the animation of the U.S. Air flight that landed in the Hudson and so forth. They're mm-hmm. still doing neat stuff. Back then, though, you know, this was a fairly new thing to try to do. And the fellow at AGI who was working on it, Rob Hall, called me and said, "Hey, I found something interesting here that you're not going to expect." I said, "Well, what is it?" And he said, "Well, we tried an animation if they had not been able to make their corrective rocket firing. You know, right after the explosion, the first thing they had to do was make a rocket firing to put them back on a so-called free return path."
Right. This is where they were going to loop around the moon and come right back into the Earth.
Yeah, because basically from Apollo 12 on, in order to save fuel, I think it was, they took themselves off the free return on the way to the moon, and they went into what was called a hybrid trajectory.
Right.
Well, that was fine as long as you didn't have any problems with the spacecraft that prevented you from going into orbit around the moon. Well, on Apollo 13, they had that explosion, and if they hadn't gone back on the free return, you know, the free return trajectory was designed so that as you loop around the moon, when you come around the other side, you're at just the right direction to and speed to reach the Earth without making another rocket firing.
Right.
And that's why it was called the free return. On Apollo 8, that was their insurance policy in case something went wrong and they weren't able to go into orbit around the moon. They would still have a free ticket home. Well, Apollo 13 had given up its free ticket home before the explosion. And so the first thing they had to do was fire the lunar module's engine to get back on the free return. And they were able to do that. But what Rob Hall and his gang at AGI did was they tried a scenario, what if they had not been able to make that engine firing? What if they had not gotten back on the free return? Well, they would have missed the Earth. We know that.
Right.
And they would have died. The astronauts would have died. And what we all thought, what I thought, what Jim Lovell thought when I talked to him, what Ron Howard thought when he made the movie and everybody else, was that they would have never returned to Earth. They would have been lost in space forever.
A big looping solar orbit. We would never see him again, if not for centuries.
Yeah, a big looping odd orbit around the Earth that stretched God knows where and would never again re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. Well, what they found at AGI was that was not actually true, that sometime after that. Now, the crew would have died, but the spacecraft with the dead astronauts aboard would have passed close enough to the moon on one of its orbits that the moon's gravity would have shifted the orbital path such that it did come back to Earth and burn up in the atmosphere.
Yeah. That's...
And, you know, it sounds kind of morbid. It sounds the kind of detail, you know, why would anybody want to even go into this? Well,
right.
You know, for the sake of history, it is an interesting thing to know. And so, you know, we put that up, and now, 10 years later, AGI has made a really spiffy new animation of it, and I've re-recorded my my narration, and that's what has been posted up on the web. It was on Rob Perlman's Collect Space website, if you haven't seen it anywhere else.
I've seen it, and I know Wired, I think Wired had a link to it on their online site as well.
Yeah, so it's been getting a lot of attention. And, you know, these anniversaries are, and you know this, Jim, the public has a kind of a limited attention span for Apollo, and the anniversaries end up being the times when we can talk about it. And so here we are at the 40th anniversary of Apollo 13. And we're looking back. You know, I want to say Apollo 13 is such a fascinating story, and I sort of re-immersed myself again when my wife and I put out the book Voices from the Moon last year.
Right, which we talked about, yeah.
And it has all the quotes from my interviews with the astronauts. But in the Apollo 13 chapter of that book, there's some amazing stuff. For example, Jim Lovell actually told me that, you know, he said, look, we get asked all the time, did you carry suicide pills? And he said, there was no point in that. We would have just opened the front hatch,
mm-hmm.
and you'd let all the air, you know, you didn't die instantly as the air rushed out of the cabin. But he said, you know, our plan was that we would continue to transmit data as long as we possibly could. We would go farther out than anybody. You know, he was telling me this, that in the back of his mind, this was his plan in case they didn't get back. Now, he never really, you know, I think once they did get back on the free return, once they got into the lunar module and saw that the systems were still working, that the water was available to cool the electronics and so forth, they had plenty of oxygen, you know, they didn't think they were going to die. But in the back of their mind, they were having these thoughts.
Yeah, what do you do? What if, you know, and I know the talk during the Project Gemini when they were doing the spacewalks would – I know Mike Collins wrote about this in Carrying the Fire. You know, would you cut the hose and let the other guy go and to close the hatch? And I know you talk about the morbid fascination. I find it fascinating every time I come across it to read the speech that President Nixon would have read to the nation had the Apollo 11 crew died on the moon.
I know, it is. It's so hard – when you have a success – like Apollo was, you know, you look back and it's kind of a temptation to feel like, well, that's the way it was supposed to go. But Apollo 13 reminds us how tricky it was, how much of a fine edge those guys were on. They, you know, it was incredible that it went as well as it did, but the chance was always there that something could go terribly wrong.
Well, and Andy, with about a minute or so left to go here, I imagine, you know, that there may be other surprises out there. You know, we know, you know, a lot, certainly from talking to the guys about what happened on the lunar surface, not all of which was beamed back by television. The, you know, the Tom Hanks miniseries got into some of that a little bit. You wonder until we go back up there, what else is there to be found? What else is there that's hiding in history that until we go do some things, we go back to the moon and or even until some of these guys, perhaps other guys, pass on and families tell secrets, what is there left, do you suppose, to know?
I don't know, and I think some of it we'll never know. I think there are probably going to be some little stories here and there that just don't get told by the astronauts and go with them. I know that I'm always finding out little things here and there, not just about what happened in space, but what happened on the ground.
Sure.
And one of the things about Apollo 13 that's so amazing is how incredible that ground effort was. And, of course, Ron Howard highlighted that. But I'll give you one final example. I asked Ken Mattingly, who was the guy who was bumped from that mission, how he felt about Apollo 13. And you would think he would have felt like, oh, boy, that was I dodged a bullet there, you know, and he got to go to the moon on Apollo 16. He didn't feel that way. He felt like he should have been there. that his place was on that spacecraft because that was his mission.
Hmm.
And he said, does that make any sense? Hell no.
But that's the
nonetheless,
way it was.
He feels that way.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
It's such an incredible, massive story Apollo is. That's one of the reasons I've always believed that Apollo is a story that we need to keep telling and retelling to our children and our grandchildren.
And it seems every time we talk to someone here at the Cape that was a part of it, we find another little piece of it. And so,
yeah, and now it's got to motivate us to take the next steps write the next chapter.
Well, Andy, go figure out what that next chapter is, and we'll talk again real soon. There's always
all right, Jim,
there's the Apollo 14 anniversary coming up in another year, so we'll talk to you soon.
And there's more on those books, by the way, on my website, andrewchaikin.com.
Thanks, Andy. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Jim.
Okay. And we're going to take our five-minute built-in hold here and be back in just a little bit. More Space Talk coming at you, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Behnke. You are listening to WMMB. Stay tuned, guys. We'll be right back.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to this second half of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. 321-768-1240, still the number to call here into the studio, *1240 for AT&T wireless customers along the Space Coast. And spacetalking@AOL.com will get you email here into the studio, as Bob has done during the last few minutes. Bob, I wish I had Andy with me still. Asking about Apollo 13, have you ever seen or heard about the video of the Apollo 13 explosion that Northwestern University recorded from their Evanston Observatory? Well, I don't think I've ever seen it, and if it is the same observation that you're talking about that I read about in Henry Cooper's book, 13, The Flight That Failed, one of my favorite books reading growing up, he starts the book by talking about this college that had some people up on the roof, and they were watching in the area where Apollo 13 was and noticed this little sort of star forming and then growing ever larger. And what they were seeing was a reflection of the sunlight off of the oxygen cloud that had burst open from the Apollo 13 service module. And so if that's the same school and the same roof and the same observatory, Bob, yes, I have heard about it. And I can actually go back into that book and check that detail. Maybe I'll send you an email later. But, yes, it definitely was observed from the ground, which I think is another fascinating thing, that they knew something was going on even before Mission Control did, in the sense that what might possibly be happening. Okay, onward to some new things here. Well, as you know, the Space Shuttle program winding up here, the fourth of the last flights are counting down right now. Discovery to launch Monday, three more to go after that, maybe a fourth. Maybe extended. Who knows? We'll see what the president says on April 15th. But for right now, there are three orbiters planned to be retired, and the ultimate location of those orbiters, the ultimate landing spot, if you will, for those orbiters is up in the air. Museums around the country are interested in procuring one. There is a competition of sorts underway. Certainly here in Florida, we want one, and there are other places that are involved. And if you've been seeing in the news lately, New York City has been very vocal and very on top of it during the last couple of weeks as they've gone fully public with their campaign. There has been rallies. There has been letters of support from government officials. They've had senators calling NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden. They'd like to put an orbiter on the Intrepid Air and Space Museum at the end of one of the piers up there in New York City in Manhattan. The idea to put one of the orbiters in a glass-enclosed structure on top of the deck of the former Intrepid aircraft carrier, which did play a role in the space program in the early days. They're raising money. They're making noise. And we thought, well, shoot, with all the noise they're making, we better make sure that people know that what we're doing here in Florida to get and keep an orbiter here is happening as well. And to that end, that effort began more than a year ago. And in fact, I was very honored to be asked to initiate some of that work in putting together a team of folks, a committee, if you will. And since then, I have turned the baton over to former astronaut John McBride, who now works for the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex for Delaware North. And John overseeing that effort and joins us from the Visitor Complex today to spend a few moments talking about it. John, good afternoon. How's it going?
It's going fine, Jim. We got a nice crowd out here today on a beautiful Sunday or Saturday afternoon here. So
yeah, that's the place to be, I'll tell you.
Yes,
I don't know why I'm in the studio.
All the folks listening who have never been out here, they need to come. And even if you've been here in the last 10 or 20 years, it's nothing like it was when you were here before, so it's something you need to witness again.
Absolutely. I highly encourage that and endorse that as well. John, talk about the effort to Florida. Keep one here. We want to keep an orbiter here. There's three left. There's 20 or so folks that places that want them. What are we doing? What's up? What can we share?
Well, before we get into our effort, you talked about the Intrepid up in New York. I think their latest planning I heard just in the last three or four days is that they want to place this glass cubicle now around Times Square somewhere instead of out on the ship. So that's
interesting. I hadn't heard that yet.
Yeah, that's a small change in their strategy. But as you well know, and we all thought when we started this effort over a year ago, that the closer we get to the actual retirement of the orbiters, there are more people that are going to throw their hats in the ring, and obviously that's happening. Got folks on the West Coast that want one. Obviously, the Johnson Space Center wants one, and Marshall wants one up in Alabama, and Oklahoma wants one, and it just spreads all over the country. And that's logical because this is a artifact of national significance and national history, and who's not infatuated by the space shuttle? So who wouldn't want one to play when they get them retired? Obviously, we folks here in Florida think, since they've all been launched and turned around here, and we get the most people, so to speak, to come to see the space relics, why wouldn't we get one here at the Kennedy Space Center? That's what logic would tell you. But, of course, as you and I also know, that sometimes logic and politics and other things don't mix too well. So you've got to really get out front and promote yourselves and make sure that you get noticed so that when the time does come to dole out one of these orbiters, that we're right in the front of the line. And I think we are. We've got, obviously, all of our local businessmen and politicians are highly supportive. We're hoping for a memorial, they call a memorial resolution from our legislature in Tallahassee that will come out in unanimous support of replacing an orbiter here after retirement. Our congressional delegation, almost down to a person in Washington, has written a letter to the administrator and the president recommending that we locate one here in Florida. And I don't think that if you talk to all the other competitors that, well, maybe there's somebody. I haven't heard of anybody that doesn't think that number one, well, obviously number one goes to the Air and Space Museum by law, but then I can't think of anybody that would really say that Kennedy Space Center should not be next in the line. Now, who gets the second, you know, and the third one, that's up for negotiation.
That's a tough one to call. And you know, and I have my own opinions on that too, which by the way, I'll just quickly share, is that, you know, I see this going this way. I think I see this going where Discovery, by name, by the way, that the Space Shuttle Discovery is going to the National Air and Space Museum. That's the one that's going. They've already started looking at Enterprise, the drop test vehicle that never did fly in space, that's been on display there for a long time. They're looking at it now to make sure it can get back up on the 747 again and be moved somewhere. So Discovery is going to go to the Air and Space Museum up on the Dulles, Virginia Museum. Enterprise, let's put it aside for now. I think for sure we're going to – I agree, John. I think we're going to get Endeavor. I think that's the one we want. I think that's the one we ought to have. And that's a matter of, you know, just keeping it right here. You don't have to transport anywhere. I imagine we can ask you formally what the plans are in a moment, but it'll stay here. Then that leaves Atlantis. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base up in Dayton, Ohio, the home of the Air Force Museum. Now, Atlantis's first flight was a DOD flight. The shuttle program owes a lot to the Department of Defense for its existence and for its operation and for its very design. The shape of the space shuttle space plane wouldn't be the way it is today if it weren't for the requirements of the Department of Defense during the late 70s as this thing was put together.
Oh, yeah, I was test pilot training out in Edwards Air Force Base when we did the X-24 and the other lifting body types of approaches and design those airplanes to fly to test the parameters of a potential space shuttle. So, yeah, they've been very instrumental. One of the options I've also heard, Jim, is maybe that they'll move the Enterprise out to Wright-Patterson.
Well, and what I was thinking was if you put Atlantis at Wright-Patterson and you leave Enterprise to either go to Houston or maybe even all the way out to the West Coast so the people who don't necessarily come over here can have something. The Seattle Museum of Flight's great. I don't know whether you'd put it back in – at Palmdale Edwards. I'm not sure there's a lot of traffic there in terms of tourism, but
a great place to, you know, for historical purposes. But like you say, there's very few people that make that 90-mile trek out to the middle of the desert to look at much of anything.
Although they ought to, because it's a cool place.
Oh, it is a wonderful place, and people that go to Edwards Air Force Base, it's a jewel in the rough diamond in the rough.
Diamond in the rough. That's right.
And you know, the West Coast option is obviously this space shuttle belongs to all of America, so one on the West Coast makes a lot of sense. The Museum of Flight's a wonderful place. So,
you know,
I think when you get past the first two, it's going to be really a dogfight. And what we've been encouraging the administration and Mr. Bolton to do is make these decisions pretty early on, so that people don't spend millions of dollars in a turf battle, so to speak, and PR campaigns and trips to Washington, D.C., and just you know, it could turn into a real dogfight, and I don't think that's what we need. So the earlier these decisions are made, I think the better off we'll all
be. Yeah, I agree. You know, I see pictures of school children in New York City with big signs that they've made at home, and that's, it's all very charming and endearing, but, you know, again, is it going to be the best place to go? You know, who knows? We'll see. But you're right. The decision needs to be made sooner than later. And it, when the decision is made and one goes our way, John, do we have good plans yet in place for what we're going to do to display it? Are we ready to reveal
any of
that?
We've got two or three options, and one of the other reasons or reasoning for an early decision is, you know, it's not a trivial pursuit to house this orbiter once it's retired. You can't just take it one day and put it on display the next. It's going to take there are certain requirements outlined by NASA and the curatorial requirements that really you've got to spend a year, I'm guessing maybe 2 years, not only to design and fabricate and build this thing to get it ready. It's not like you can get it one day and have it ready the next. So
the
early they make decision, then people who are going to get one can go ahead and start their planning process. One of the things we're looking at here at Kennedy is temporarily, if maybe not permanently, we don't know, is to put it in one of our orbital processing facilities for 3 or 4 or 5 years, assuming we get the clearance from the safety people. That, in my mind, for the people who are touring here and they take their bus trip and we just stop one more time and allow them 30 minutes to spend time walking in and under and around the orbiter in its natural habitat where the men and thousands of men and women who worked on it for the last 30 years did all their labor and loving care of this shuttle, took care of it in its own little house there. It would be a magnificent experience for anybody that had that opportunity. And concurrently, we would design and build, if necessary, we've got kind of tentative plans to build a permanent structure here at the visitor center itself, which would house the orbiter for ad infinitum, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that would be an absolutely outstanding way to do it. And it's neat enough to see a shuttle standing by itself, but when you put it in its cocoon of scaffolding and then having a chance to kind of walk around it and be really quite up close and personal with it.
You really don't have a great appreciation for the size and the complexity of this vehicle until you've been within about 10 feet of it.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, I still get goosebumps when I go to, I flew the shuttle and I've been in there several times, but every time I go to that VAB and watch a stack or go over to the orbital processing facility and just get up close to this I still get goosebumps, you know, just excited about seeing and being around, I think, man's most complicated flying machine ever.
John, thanks a lot. We're going to take a pause here. We'll be back with you another time to talk more. This is Jim Behnke, WMMB. You're listening to Space Talk.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
And as we begin our final segment of today's Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance, I want to quick give my thanks to the Merritt Island Rotary Club for hosting me as their speaker this past Thursday. Jimmy Vickers and the gang over there was very nice to talk to, had a good discussion about the future of our space program. And let me tell you, there are folks in and out of this program that are still very concerned about this future, as what it might mean to the space people, to the community. And we're going to get into that big time next week as we prepare for a couple of events here happening, not to mention the fact that President Obama is coming here on April 15th. Real quick, let's go to the phones. Bob from Melbourne wants to talk about Apollo 13. Welcome to Space Talk, Bob.
Well, yeah, good afternoon, Jim. Just quickly, since you were going back in time there with the history and the what-ifing on Apollo 13 and reminding ourselves that miracles do happen in our lives, if you think about the template of an Apollo mission, which was roughly, 9 days, eight to 10 days, 9 days.
Right.
And during the mission, there's a number of times when the crew would do the activity that resulted in the explosion, stir the cryos, which is when they turn the heaters and the fans on in the cryogenic tanks to keep a good mixture of the liquid and the gas, for which, of course, supplies, in this case, oxygen for breathing air in the fuel cells. Well, if you think about when that happened, it when the sparks occurred and they threw the switch when that happened. That was in a roughly 2 to 3 day period of time when the command service module and lunar module were docked together, and the integrity of those two spacecraft had been established. And as a result, they had a chance, thanks to the heroics of the flight team and the flight crew, to get the combined spaceship of these two spacecraft, you know, around the moon and, mm-hmm. and back toward on the right trajectory to Earth. If it had happened before that, before the command service module had undocked from the third stage and the structure where the lunar module was, it's questionable if they would have had the ability to undock and turn around the command service module and dock with the lunar module.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They would have tried it, of course, but would they have the controllability? You know, you could, yeah. You don't know.
It'd be tough.
Course, if it happened after the two separated in lunar orbit, then you don't have the lunar module
right
to get you back. So,
let alone that you've got the crew separated.
Right. So the only time, you know, when you know, and you can speculate whether or not the service propulsion system would have given them, you know, would have worked well enough to, you know, get them back to Earth. They would have tried it, obviously, but the only time they really had a good chance to do this was in that roughly 2 to 3 day period when the two had been docked together, coasting to the moon after they'd done their, you know, their injection out of Earth orbit. So, if you believe in miracles, I think one happened on that mission.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Bob. You're back in town?
Yes.
You know, I should tell everyone, if you don't recognize the man's voice, and I don't know if you're trying to call him anonymously, but there's no way you can get away with it. We were talking to Bob Seek, former KSC launch director, and you know, he knows his stuff. And you're right, Bob. The miracles that have happened in our program, the coincidence of timing, you know, that keep happening when good things and bad things happen. Just the right moment, right place. You know, there's definitely something bigger than all of us watching over this whole thing. And at the same time, the heroic efforts of launch teams and flight teams to put all this stuff together and make it happen, you know, and you're right. The Apollo 13 couldn't have happened the way it did if it hadn't actually blown exactly when it did.
Right.
A little bit later and you're in trouble. A little bit earlier, you're in trouble, and absolutely so. So, well, good. Thanks for those observations, and we're going to talk here a little bit about Apollo 13 anniversary. Bob, we'll talk to you again real soon.
Okay. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks,
bye.
Buddy. Bye. Okay, well, now that's a deal. That's a deal to have our friend, the KSC launch director, call in. The man is a legend, even though he won't admit it. Let's see here. April, anniversary month, basically. There's all sorts of stuff going on here. And with just a couple minutes remaining, I want to tell you about a couple of things that are going on and ways that you can plug in. First of all, before we get back to Apollo 13, I want to mention that that on April 12th is the anniversary of the 49th anniversary of the first man to go in space, Yuri Gagarin, the Russian cosmonaut. And about 10 years ago, they started an event called Yuri's Night. It was very much you could almost call it a viral event, using the online words. It was something that was started by some younger folks, started here, started in Moscow, and it's kind of grown each year and attracts a very different kind of crowd, which is really neat to see some other kind of people involved and excited about space. And it's called Yuri's Night, and this year Yuri's Night is going to be next Saturday, a week from today, April 10th. Locally, the event is going to be centered at the Astronaut Hall of Fame up there near Titusville. The doors are going to be open at 8, and all of the exhibits and displays that are part of the Astronaut Hall of Fame will be available to everybody. And there's going to be some entertainment. There's going to be some science demonstrations. There's some former astronauts are going to be on hand. Door prizes, including travel vouchers from JetBlue Airways. All will be taking place again next Saturday, Yuri's Night at the Astronaut Hall of Fame. Again, tickets are at the door. Door opens at 8. And by the way, so that you know, this is actually only one of more than 100 parties and events in 36 countries. On all the major six continents, I guess everybody in Antarctica, hosting Yuri's Night's events each year. So, again, this is becoming a bigger deal every year, and I encourage you to be part of it. In the meantime, Real quick, Apollo 13 celebrations at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex are set for next Friday, April 9th, and Saturday, April 10th. Friday, April 9th at 3:30 in the afternoon, astronaut Charlie Duke will be there signing his book, Moonwalker. And Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes, the Apollo 13 astronauts. Of course, we lost Jack Swigert years ago. Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes will be at the visitor complex as part of the normal astronaut encounter next Saturday morning, April 10th at 10:30 a.m. Regular admission to the visitor complex. Get in there in the morning, and you can meet and talk with Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes at 10:30 next Saturday. Let's see here. What else? We've got time for maybe one more announcement. Next Sunday, 3 o'clock at the Cocoa Expo is the Save Space Rally being organized by Brevard County Commissioner Robin Fisher. We're going to talk more about that next week, but I just want to make sure it's on your calendar. It's going to be a big deal over at the Cocoa Expo Center next Sunday, 3 o'clock, the Cocoa Expo Center, the Save Space Rally, in anticipation of the president's visit here to the Kennedy Space Center on April 15th. Next week on Space Talk, our special guest is going to be Roy Tharp, who was selected as the National Space Club Florida Committee Board of Directors for the Kurt Debus Award, named for our first Kennedy Space Center director, the Debus Award, Florida's most prestigious space-related honor. And Roy Tharp is the winner, and he's going to be with us in the studio next week. And we're going to talk about him and his career and a lot of neat things. Meanwhile, Discovery Launch, 6:21 in the morning Monday. Our live coverage here on WMMB begins at 5:30, and we'll carry through to the Bill Mix Show. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. Space Talk is sponsored by United Space Alliance and is a production of Mylas Solutions. Aaron Michaels is the Starship's chief engineer here. I'm Jim Banky. We'll talk to you again real soon. Now, don't go anywhere. Dan Connery is next. Live and local radio continues on a Saturday afternoon right here on WMMB.